Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, November 9, and I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, a photo and the caption in bold, "The Calm Before the Cold." A great egret fishes Monday in the waters of the Manhattan Robins Lake Park in northwest Cedar Rapids on an unusually warm and sunny fall day. But a weak cold front arriving with the first significant storm of the season will step down temperatures starting today until they are some 20 degrees colder by the weekend, going from above average highs to below average. In fact, the National Weather Service warns Friday will be a windy and raw day across the area. A great egret dives for a fish Monday in the waters off of the Robins Lake Park in Cedar Rapids. Also in the weather news, this by Vanessa Miller, I guess not weather, but rather lunar news, Iowa gets a front row seat to a long eclipse. Although the retreat from daylight saving time might have worn off by November 19, anyone still riding that extra hour into pre-dawn wakefulness might get to see this month's beaver moon turn blood red when North America gets a front row seat to the century's longest lunar eclipse. Iowans willing to drag themselves from bed for the partial lunar eclipse, expected to last 3 hours, 28 minutes, and 23 seconds, according to NASA, will start seeing the moon pass through the Earth's shadow after 1 a.m., reaching a maximum eclipse about 3 a.m., according to University of Iowa Physics and Astronomy Associate Professor Jasper Halicus. It should be very visible in Iowa, he said. Basically, all over North America is maximum visibility. Of course, celestial viewing requires clear or at least somewhat clear skies, but should weather cooperate, the partial lunar eclipse over eastern Iowa will start at 1:18 a.m., reach its peak when the moon is closest to the center of Earth's shadow at 3:02 a.m. and end at 4:47 a.m. Although this event isn't officially categorized as a total lunar eclipse, the Earth's shadow will block 97% of the sun's light, meaning most of the moon will appear red in those pre-dawn hours. There will be a little sliver of light around the edge of it because it's not a 100% eclipse, Halicus said, noting the rest will probably end up looking a little bit reddish. Lunar eclipses are essentially the opposite of solar eclipses, Halicus said, where solar eclipses occur when the moon moves between the Earth and the sun, blocking its light. A lunar eclipse occurs when the Earth moves between the sun and moon, blocking light the moon typically reflects. Though the moon is in Earth's shadow during lunar eclipses, some sunlight still seeps around and reaches the orbital body, according to NASA. But because it first passes through Earth's atmosphere, most blue light filters out, making the moon seem red. Lunar eclipses can occur only during full moon phases. NASA reports Earth will experience 57 partial and 85 total lunar eclipses this century. The longest and shortest total lunar eclipses already occurred in July 2018 and April 2015, respectively. The shortest partial eclipse won't happen until February 13, 2082, according to NASA. The next total lunar eclipse is expected May 16, 2022, followed by another November 8, 2022. Lunar eclipses can be seen only in parts of the world where the moon is above the horizon, and the upcoming event is tailor-made for sky gazers in North America, with prime viewing across all 50 states, Canada, and Mexico. According to a map NASA produced, those living in South America, Western Europe, and West Africa will see a portion of the eclipse at moonset. Australia and Asia will catch some of the eclipse at moonrise, and most of Africa and Middle East will miss the whole thing. Although scientists long have tracked orbital dynamics and have mapped out eclipses for hundreds of years, Halicus said they still can use eclipses to advance research, including their understanding of how events affect the moon. It's kind of a unique physical situation where you go from having full light on part of the moon to having that light taken away and then having it come back, he said. And you actually can do some observations of what happens to the temperature of the surface as that happens that tell you some interesting things about the physical properties of the moon's surface. As to whether Halicus plans to wake up early to catch this month's unusually long blood moon, he hasn't decided. I usually get up and go for a morning run at about 5 a.m., he said, so it's only a couple hours early. Turning to page 2, the Iowa Today page, this story by Elizabeth Zaluska from Iowa City, arrest of IC Truth Panel chair elicits concerns. Though Mohamed Traor has been a visible presence in the community for months, attending city council meetings and leading the council-created Truth and Reconciliation Commission to help take on racial injustice, police acted on a nearly 2-year-old order to arrest him on a drunk driving charge shortly after the commission had ended its meeting last week. Traor, age 26, who was arrested outside City Hall, was booked at 9:42 p.m. Thursday in the Johnson County Jail and released afternoon Friday, according to the jail roster. He could not be reached for comment Monday. Fellow commission member Eric Harris said the timing of the arrest, quote, doesn't make sense at all, end quote. It makes us feel that we are at risk, Harris said. We're in the City Hall every other week. They could have done this a long time ago, so the timing is suspicious. Harris and others tried to go to the jail Friday to visit Traor, but were told they couldn't because he had to be in quarantine. Harris said commission members feel on edge after the arrest, and the situation doesn't help a tense relationship that has grown between the commission and the city council that created it in the first place. The commission is tasked with gathering testimony in the community about racial injustices and fostering ways for people to share their stories. Its members have faced roadblocks since the commission was created last year. The panel has been struck by resignations and is facing an uncertain future after the city council rejected hiring a facilitator for it despite approving the budget for one. The city released a statement acknowledging the arrest could have been addressed in a more private manner, removed from the context of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission meeting. While I believe our officers were acting with the best intentions, I am keenly aware of the message the timing of this arrest sends to our community, Police Chief Dustin Liston said in a statement. We support the mission of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and will continue to work to build trust with members of the community. The second offense, OWI charge, is from January 2019. Traor pleaded guilty in April 2019. And was sentenced to 7 days in jail and fined, according to court records. If he had not surrendered within 120 days to serve the jail time, records show, police could pick him up on a mitimus order. Johnson County Attorney Janet Linus said it is her understanding that Traor hadn't served all of his jail sentence. A mitimus order means that any officer who encounters a person with a mitimus out, they should pick up that person and deliver them to jail to serve the sentence, Linus said. This happens frequently when judges allow people to schedule their jail sentence so people don't go to jail immediately when they are sentenced. Then people never show up to actually serve their sentence. Linus said during the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic, the county was trying to keep individuals out of the jail, so officers were not picking up people on such orders. I'm sure there are a lot of people in this situation, and the police are trying to find these people and get them to serve their sentence, Linus said. Traor told the Iowa City Press Citizen last week he was not aware there was a warrant out for him or that he hadn't served his full sentence. His probation officer did not tell him about it, Traor said. Traor will need to serve the rest of his sentence by January 1, according to court records. Also on the Today page, a girl age 12 is killed in an UTV crash, this by Aaron Jordan. The 12-year-old girl died Sunday in a utility task vehicle crash in Buchanan County. Around 5:20 p.m., Buchanan County Sheriff's deputies responded to a 911 call of a UTV crash near 260th Street and Buffalo Creek Boulevard, southeast of Winthrop, the agency said on Monday. A 12-year-old girl driving a Polaris Ranger UTV with a passenger lost control of the vehicle, which rolled over into the ditch, ejecting the driver and pinning her underneath, the sheriff's office reported. The juvenile passenger was not injured. Life-saving attempts were not successful, so the girl was transported to a hospital where she was pronounced dead. The crash is under investigation. The UTV is bigger than an all-terrain vehicle and allows for two people to ride side by side. Other agencies that responded to the crash were the Winthrop Fire Department, AMR Ambulance, and AirCare. And also on the Iowa Today page, Masher won't seek re-election to the House in 2022. She's the second Iowa City Democratic lawmaker to announce plans to leave the legislature. This story is by James Lynch. After more than a quarter of a century representing Iowa City, State Representative Mary Masher has announced she will not seek re-election in 2022. In announcing her retirement, Masher thanked Johnson County voters for their love and support over the last 28 years. It has truly been an honor to represent the people in Iowa City, University Heights, and Hills, Masher, age 69, said. I'm looking forward to continuing to be their voice in the Statehouse during the 2022 session. Among the accomplishments Masher and House Democrats achieved during their majority from 2007 to 2010 included increasing the minimum wage, banning smoking in public places, protecting LGBTQ rights in the Civil Rights Code, investing in solar and wind energy programs, and establishing the 4-year-old voluntary preschool program in the state. During those years, state funding for our public universities, community colleges, private colleges, and K-12 schools has increased yearly, Masher added. These strides have made a long-lasting impact on the lives of many Iowans. Masher is the second Iowa City Democratic legislator to announce retirement this month. State Senator Joe Bolcom announced last week he will not seek re-election to a seventh term. Born in Iowa City, Masher grew up on a century farm in Johnson County and has been an active member of the community for many years. She was an elementary teacher and counselor in the Iowa City Community School District for 33 years. Masher currently represents the 86th House District and is serving her 14th term in the Iowa House. Her committee assignments include the Transportation, Infrastructure, and Capitals Appropriations Subcommittee, and serving as the ranking member of the House State Government Committee. In addition, Masher serves on the Early Childhood Iowa State Board and the Investment Board of the Iowa Public Employees Retirement System. I'm looking forward to this next chapter in my life, and I will continue to be active in local party politics, she said. I'm committed to community organizations that help those who struggle with housing and food insecurity. Quality, affordable, accessible early childhood education continues to be a top priority for the people of Johnson County, and I will join forces with others to make that a reality for hardworking families. Also in the Iowa Today news, this story by Trish Mahaffey, teen charged in Malik Sheets' murder accepts a plea agreement. One of the teens charged with killing University of Iowa student Malik Sheets during a party last summer will plead to lesser charges. First Assistant Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks is asking a judge to separate trials for Marshawn L. Jeffries, age 18, and Christian Amedi, 18, who are jointly charged with first-degree murder and obstruction of prosecution. Maybanks also is asking for Amedi's trial, now set for November 16, to be reset because Jeffries has accepted a plea agreement. There are no details of the tentative plea for Jeffries in court documents. Maybanks, in the motion, said another reason to reset the trial is he filed additional minutes of testimony in Amedi's case just last week. The defense is asking a judge to exclude those additional minutes of testimony and witnesses from trial because the late notice is so close to trial and the defense has not received all the information. The last-minute testimony of those witnesses violates Amedi's right to a fair trial, due process, and equal protection of the law, the defense said. The defense argues the prosecution is attempting to force them to seek a continuance, which they don't want because Amedi has been in jail for nearly a year and a half. Sixth District Judge Ian Thornhill has not ruled on either motion. In a previous hearing, Thornhill denied the defense's motion for moving Amedi's trial out of Linn County and a motion questioning the competence of one of the prosecution's witnesses. Cedar Rapids police, after responding to a report of shots fired around 5 a.m. June 18 at 1058 Regent Avenue Northeast, found Sheets badly injured inside the house where a large party had been held earlier. Sheets died from gunshot wounds to his neck and chest. Investigators learned from witnesses that Sheets and several others were arguing when two people, identified as Amedi and Jeffries, shot him, according to the criminal complaint. During a hearing last month, Cedar Rapids Police Investigator Matt Denlinger testified that witnesses said Amedi assaulted one person and shot Sheets. After Sheets fell to the floor, Jeffries then fired at point-blank range at his body. Maybank said during a bail review hearing, Amedi and Jeffries fled to Gurnee, Illinois on June 19, where they were arrested. The teens, if convicted of first-degree murder, would face life sentences, but because they are juveniles, they would be eligible for parole at some point, unlike adults convicted of the same charge. This story by Michaela Ram, Linn County Public Health welcomes Deputy Director. Linn County Public Health has hired Eric Bradley, an official at Scott County Health Department, as new Deputy Director. He will start November 22nd. We are pleased to welcome Eric Bradley to our agency, LCPH Director Pramod Dwivedi said in a statement. Eric brings with him comprehensive public health knowledge and experience essential to strengthen and enhance capacity of LCPH. Bradley has worked at Scott County Health Department, which includes Davenport, as an environmental health manager for 6 years. He has 25 years of experience in public health overall, according to Linn County officials. He earned a Master of Public Health degree from American Public University in Virginia and a bachelor's degree in environmental health from the University of Georgia. I look forward to working with the department's staff and the community to address the public health problems we all face and to increase the positive impact LCPH has on the people of Linn County, Bradley said in a statement. And brothers organize picket at the deer to show unity, this by Kara Smith. More than 50 UAW picketers lined John Deere Place waving homemade signs at honking cars Monday afternoon, day 26 of the strike against Deere and Company, outside the company's headquarters in Moline. With music playing from the bed of a pickup and children running around in a field behind the line, United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers of America from across the United States stood in solidarity with Deere workers advocating for an improved tentative agreement across from the main entrance to Deere's corporate offices. The informational picket was sponsored by brothers Brian and Shannon Olson, who both work at John Deere Engine Works in Waterloo, independent from the UAW. The brothers said they organized the event to facilitate unity between locals. We really united 3 weeks ago, and it seems as if there's a little bit of division going on. We need to stand united for all blue-collar workers across America, Shannon Olson said. I think that brings unity by getting people together, talking about our plans, our goals, you know, our futures, and that will create unity. The UAW rejected a second tentative contract agreement, 55% to 45%, despite gaining majority support from some Quad City Union locals. The contract, which offered improved wages and other benefits, was rejected by locals in Waterloo and Dubuque. Quad City workers reported last week that the close margin was creating tension within the UAW and local chapters. Both brothers said they are against another vote on the same agreement. It's been turned down, Brian Olson said. You've got to come up with a better offer if you want us back to work. He said that although the deer workers were directly advocating for themselves, the outcome of the strike could shift the wages and benefits for all workers in the manufacturing industry. The reason why we're here today is to raise the standard of living for not just John Deere workers, but all blue-collar workers, he said, for standard raises for everybody in our community. And that community includes our dads, moms, and aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters. We have an opportunity to raise their standard of living. Traveling over an hour to get to the headquarters was an easy decision, according to the brothers. They wanted to unite the movement near the company's chief executive and other leaders. Multiple signs that read, post-retirement health care, quality employees deserve quality pay for quality work, and we are essential were held feet away from the Deere corporate sign. We're all under one roof, even though we're in different locals, Brian Olson said. It's important to get all these people together because we're all fighting for the same thing. And here are some short bits of news from different areas. In Fort Dodge, a man age 18 is critically wounded in a shooting. An 18-year-old man was critically injured Sunday in a shooting in Fort Dodge. Police said it was reported around 4:20 a.m. When officers arrived, they found the man with gunshot wounds in his abdomen. The Fort Dodge Messenger reports the man was flown to a hospital in Des Moines for treatment. Investigators determined the shooting took place inside an apartment before the man fled. He was found in a nearby parking lot. Police found a gun after the shooting. One person was killed and another wounded in a rural western Iowa shooting that stemmed from a domestic disturbance, according to sheriff's officials. The shooting happened Sunday morning at a home in Pottawatomie County, just east of Council Bluffs. Sheriff's Sergeant Dim Doty said deputies were called to the home for reports of a disturbance and arrived to find one person dead and the other wounded. The wounded person was taken to a hospital in nearby Omaha, Nebraska. And in Des Moines, a 15-year-old boy is critically wounded. Police in Des Moines are investigating a shooting over the weekend that critically wounded a 15-year-old. The shooting happened late Sunday morning when officers were called to an area in the Evelyn Davis Park neighborhood. Officers arrived to find someone performing CPR on the wounded teen who was taken to a hospital in critical condition. Police have not released the teen's name or announced any arrest. And finally, a woman dies in a house fire in Bettendorf. Firefighters were called to the home late Saturday and found heavy smoke and flames coming from the house. A man was able to escape, but a woman was trapped and died in the blaze. The state fire marshal's office is working with the Bettendorf Fire Department to determine the cause of the fire. Turning now to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial is titled, Solar Will Benefit Linn County. And actually, this is submitted by Ron Corbett. Last week, applications were submitted for the Duane Arnold solar projects. The positive economic impact associated with the projects is undeniable. According to an economic impact study conducted by Strategic Economic Research, the two projects will have a combined positive economic impact of up to $260 million on the state of Iowa, including up to $154 million in Linn County. That includes the cumulative ripple effects of new jobs, wages, tax revenue, and other economic activity during construction and over the estimated 30-year life of the projects. The kind of local investment can provide an incredible uplift to our local businesses and residents. The economic benefits from the Duane Arnold solar projects are just the start. These projects will provide renewable electricity, which many companies looking to expand in eastern Iowa now demand. Increasingly, businesses looking to grow here will not consider a local development site unless renewable energy is part of the equation. The projects would benefit Iowa in many other ways, including maintaining our clean air and water while also providing renewable electricity for Iowans. According to the application, Alliant Energy will purchase the project's ownership upon the commercial operation date. Thus, during operations, the solar projects will be owned by Alliant Energy which means the homegrown clean energy Duane Arnold Solar generates will serve Alliant Energy customers across Iowa. The Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance has long supported projects that spur economic development and growth. Duane Arnold Solar represents exactly the kind of low-impact, high-value development we should be encouraging. The company developing and constructing the projects, Next Era Energy Resources, isn't new to Iowa or Linn County. The company has been fueling Iowa's economic growth since 1999, investing approximately $2.8 billion in the state's economy. It has a proven track record of partnering with communities across the state and are looking to continue that investment in Linn County. Iowa's economy would greatly benefit if it could rely on more renewable energy production. In a local and state economy recuperating from over a year of businesses closing and financial hardships due to the pandemic, innovative projects like Duane Arnold Solar can have a transformative effect on our communities. It's time to harvest a new, sustainable crop in solar energy for everyone's benefit. And this is contributed by Ron Corbett, who is Vice President of Economic Development for the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance. Adam Solomon's At Liberty column today is titled, Time is Made Up by the Government. There was something unfamiliar at the bedroom window when I woke up Monday morning to write this column. Daylight at 7 a.m. A couple days prior, it would have been dark at that hour. Daylight saving time ended over the weekend, part of a semi-annual tradition nobody seems to like, but almost everybody does anyway. Most states, including Iowa, are looking to abolish the time switch. Across the country, at least 350 bills to do so that have been introduced since 2015, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. In the state legislature this year, a bill to make daylight saving time permanent in Iowa earned unanimous bipartisan approval from the Senate committee, but failed to advance further. Under the proposal, the change would become effective only if all six of Iowa's neighboring states adopted daylight saving time in the next decade. We couldn't be an island of daylight saving time in the Midwest here. That gives us all bordering states 10 years to come on board with this, pass their own legislation, State Senator Jeff Rieckman told Radio Iowa in February. But Iowa could be an island of daylight saving time. It would be fine. Reformers are worried that different times across state lines would lead to mass confusion. I have a little more confidence in Iowans' intelligence. There already are many Americans whose lives span multiple time zones. They're able to manage. Increasingly so with the rise of remote work. For those who aren't good at adding and subtracting small numbers, we have cell phones and calendar apps that automatically account for the difference. It's a common myth that daylight saving time was crafted to accommodate farming, but farmers historically opposed the practice. Of course, you can't really squeeze more sunshine out of the day by changing clocks. You can only reallocate it to the morning or the evening. Farmers uniquely attuned to the changing seasons will get up when their livestock and the field conditions demand it. The real justifications for daylight saving time have usually been energy conservation and war mobilization. The ways we use energy and fight wars have changed radically over the past couple centuries, but we're still using a model that resembles a joke Benjamin Franklin made in 1784 about sleeping in late. The United States instituted daylight saving time during World War I and World War II. Some states and localities subsequently kept it in place, but there was no national standard for when changing the clocks. Then, in 1966, the federal government nationalized time. The Uniform Time Act, signed by Lyndon Johnson, preempted state daylight schemes and required all participating states to start and end on the same dates. Since 2018, more than a dozen state legislatures have passed measures to end the twice-yearly time change, including Minnesota this year. Instead of defying the federal government, they are waiting for Congress to pass a bill. The sun is real, but the time on the clock is made up by the government. in our personalized, on-demand, work-from-home world, do we really need Washington, D.C. to tell us what time it is? And that's Adam Sullivan. Moving to the community letters today, there are two. This first one is titled, It's Time to Get Rid of Daylight Saving Time. It's time to unplug daylight saving time. Just resetting clocks, kitchen, living room, bathroom, bedrooms, watches, and the car is more than a nuisance. Some clocks take a manual to figure them out, and that might not work. Is that a pleasant experience? And for all this work, we are rewarded with the loss of 1 hour. Just be glad you don't have to reset air, rail, and other expensive schedules. It ain't worth it any longer. So the conclusion is quite simple. Legislate it into history. There are a number of states that never had it, and guess what? They're still around and happy not changing the time. It's called a labor-saving device. Let's see if the Iowa legislature agrees. Signed by John Carver from Decorah. In our second letter, how can Coralville cannibalize State Tourney? Is it true that the new facility in Coralville might be chosen for future state volleyball tournaments? I think it is sad if they are allowed to cannibalize, and that's in capital letters, what has been a long tradition of holding this tournament in Cedar Rapids. I use the word cannibalize deliberately, since that word was used to prevent a casino from being built in Cedar Rapids several years ago. Some days you just can't win. Why? And that's signed by Dick Lensing from Marion. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, November 9, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices, first from Cedar Rapids, Helen Marie Durek Quass, age 96, died Monday, November 8. Cedar Rapids Cremation Society is assisting. From Maquoketa, Jeremiah Weiss, age 41, died Sunday, November 7. Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. And in St. Olaf, William, known as Bill Robert Kelly, age 49, died Wednesday, November 3. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home Cremation Service in McGregor is assisting. From Belle Plaine, Florence L. Lyman, age 81, passed away November 5 at the Bridges of Ankeny Care Center after a long battle with Alzheimer's disease. Service is at 11 a.m. Saturday, November 13, at the Hrabic Newhouse Funeral Service, Belle Plaine, with Pastor Kate West officiating. The service will also be live-streamed on the Funeral Service Facebook page. Burial will take place at Oak Hill Cemetery in Belle Plaine. Visitation is from 9 to 11 before the service at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the Belle Plaine Rotary Club, Iowa Alzheimer's Association, or Hope Masonic Lodge in Belle Plaine. The Newhouse Funeral Service is assisting the family. From Williamsburg, Ruth Margaret Shanahan died Saturday, November 6, at the Highland Ridge Care Center at Williamsburg at the age of 94. She is preceded in death by her parents, husband Eugene, and two sons. Funeral Mass will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, November 11, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Williamsburg. Burial will be at St. Mary's Cemetery, with visitation from 3:30 to 5:30 Wednesday at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. There will be a rosary recited at 3:30 p.m. A memorial fund has been established for St. Mary's Catholic Church. Messages and tributes may be directed to the PowellFuneralHome.com. From Atkins, Mary Jo Freese, age 74, passed away Friday, November 5, in her home, surrounded by family. A prayer service will take place beginning at 3:30 p.m. Wednesday, November 10, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Visitation will follow from 4 to 7. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, November 11, at St. John's, and that's at 8100 Roncalli Drive in Fairfax, Iowa. From Cedar Rapids, Richard, known as Rick Kitzman, 71, of Lakeville, Minnesota, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away November 4, surrounded by his family. after battling a long illness. Services are at 10 a.m. Saturday at St. Jude Catholic Church by the Reverend Mark Murphy. Burial at St. Patrick and Paul Cemetery in Watkins. A vigil service will be held at 4 p.m. Friday at the Tien Funeral Home. Friends not attending the vigil service may visit with the family from 4:30 to 8 Friday at the funeral home and after 9 a.m. Saturday at the church. From Iowa City, Norma Jean Bartles, age 95, a longtime resident, died Saturday, November 6th. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 13th at Oak Hill Cemetery in Coralville. For a complete obituary and to share a thought, memory, or condolence with her family, please visit the funeral home website at gayandchia.com. In Cedar Rapids, George Anthony Laffler, Sr., 87, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, November 7, of complications of Parkinson's disease. Services are at 11 a.m. Friday, November 12, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, where a visitation will begin at 10 a.m. until service time. Burial is at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Also in Cedar Rapids, Michael Anthony O'Neill. With our deepest sorrow, we must share that the world that Michael Anthony O'Neill, age 41, beloved son, father, brother, uncle, and friend to so many, passed away Friday, November 5. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 Thursday, November 11, at Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Funeral services will be at 1 p.m. Friday, November 12, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. From Swisher, Ernest, known as Ernie Lewis Obadahl, age 95, passed away Saturday, November 6th at his home, surrounded by family. Celebration of life services will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, November 11, at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the family, and online condolences may be expressed to the family at broshchapel.com. In Cedar Rapids, Jessica, known as Eka Tamayo Saldivar, age 53, passed away suddenly Sunday, November 7, at her home. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 Thursday, November 11, at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. There will be a celebration of life from 1 to 6 on Sunday, November 14, at the Swisher American Legion, 68 3rd Street Southeast in Swisher. From Iowa City, Nadia Paul Ellerhoff died peacefully November 6 at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, surrounded by her family after a long and courageous battle with heart disease that began when she contracted rheumatic fever as a young girl. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, November 12th at the Lansing Oak Hill Funeral Service, 210 Holiday Road, Coralville, with the Very Reverend Father Jeff Shaheen officiating. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday before the funeral. The service will be made available by way of Zoom. The link will be on Nadia's obituary page at lansingfuneral.com under her tribute wall. Family committal service will be held at St. George Orthodox Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the charity of the donor's choice. And in Riverside, Rick L. Noel, age 64, Riverside, died unexpectedly Friday, November 5th, at the Jefferson County Health Center, surrounded by family. Funeral services will be at 11:30 a.m. Friday, November 12. Family will greet guests prior to the service from 10 to 11:30 at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Burial will take place at the Lone Tree Cemetery. Following the committal service at the cemetery, a time of food and fellowship will be held at the Lone Tree American Legion. Memorials may be directed toward the Noel family in care of Margot Noel. From Marion, Linda C. McCormick, age 78, passed away Thursday, November 4. The family is planning a celebration of Linda's life at a later date. Memorials can be directed to Mount Mercy University Office of Development in Cedar Rapids. Iowa Cremation is assisting with those arrangements. In Palo, Judy Paul, age 80, passed away Saturday, November 6th at her home. Memorial donations can be directed to the family as they are planting a tree and putting up a plaque in remembrance of Judy. CedarMemorial.com is in charge of arrangements, and online condolences may be left at their website. And our last funeral notice, Jean Marie Stover of Vienna, Virginia. Jean, age 94, passed away at her home October 30. The cause of death was Lewy body dementia and other complications of advanced age. Turning now to the sports page, no high school stories to report. The women's basketball program at the University of Iowa and men's basketball both start their seasons very soon. And in local sports of interest, of course, prep football semifinals begin this week. Tomorrow, 8-player, Audubon versus CAM takes place at 10 a.m. and Easton Valley versus Remsen St. Mary's. On Thursday in Class A, East Buchanan takes on West Hancock at 10 a.m. and Woodbury Central takes on Grundy Center at 1. In Class 4A, Council Bluffs Lewis Central takes on Waverly Shell Rock at 4 p.m. and Winterset plays Cedar Rapids Xavier at 7. And these games are all played at the Unidome in Cedar Falls. Friday, Class 1A, Dyersville Beckman takes on Van Meter at 10 a.m. Dyke New Hartford plays West Sioux at 1 p.m. And in Class 5A, Ankeny takes on West Des Moines Valley at 4 p.m. Iowa City High takes on Southeast Polk at 7 p.m. And Saturday, the games are 2A and 3A, where Southeast Valley takes on Waukon at 10 a.m. Williamsburg plays West Lyon at 1. And finishing up the day in 3A, Solon plays Boydenhall Rock Valley at 4 p.m. and Harlan faces Humboldt at 7. In other sports news of note, in local golf, at Hunter's Ridge Golf Course, Al Laird of Marion scored a hole-in-one on number 14, 132 yards with a 6-iron on Monday. And at the Ellis Golf Course, Jim Roberg of Cedar Rapids scored a hole-in-one on number 14 with a 9-iron on Sunday. And at the Cedar Rapids Bowling Center, Tim Kors scored a 247 and a 664. Danette McQuiston scored 245 with a 662. And Barb Andrews rolled a 179 and 500. We turn now to the community page, and here are some things to do today. Hobby Prairie Woods Knitters and Stitchers. Create hats, mittens, blankets, baby, and other handmade items for charity. New participants and all skill levels are welcome, and no registration is necessary. This takes place from 9:30 to 11 at Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center in Hiawatha. It's free and open to all ages. In the community category, Oral Histories Live, featuring Slayton Thompson. Host Rob Klein interviews Slayton Thompson, best known for founding the All-City Drum Corps in Cedar Rapids. The Drum Corps' success not only reflects Slayton's life, but epitomizes his desire to help others, especially youngsters who need it. That takes place today at 5:30 p.m. at the History Center, 800 2nd Avenue Southeast. Cost is $5 to $7 and open to all ages. And Allyship Panel with Advocates for Social Justice and Civil Rights Commission. Want to know how to combat racism in your community? Come learn more about Allyship and ask community members on the panel how to make the Cedar Rapids community a more just and equitable place. The event includes presenters Anthony Arrington and Stephanie Munsterman Scriven, moderator Ann Harris Carter, and panelists Jeffrey Disterhoff, Donna Barnes, Akpara Rice, and Erica Bridgie. That takes place at 6 o'clock today, runs from 6 to 7:30 at the Whipple Auditorium, Cedar Rapids Public Library, and also will be live streamed on the library's Facebook page. That's free and open to all ages. And in the education category, Fear and Trauma After 9/11. On September 11, 2001, the country sustained more than physical damage and lost loved ones. The individual and collective psychological responses to 9/11, including trauma, false memories, stereotyping, and cognitive dissonance, remains with society to this day. Mount Mercy University's Fall Faculty Series presents Dr. Dennis Du, professor of psychology, as he explains the conceptual response of 9/11. That's from 6 to 7 p.m. today at the Mount Mercy University Flaherty Community Room, 1330 Elmhurst Drive in Cedar Rapids, also live streamed at MMU's YouTube channel, free and open to all ages. And in some Eastern Iowa briefs from Marion, the Marion Chamber of Commerce and City of Marion are accepting applications for the Morris F. Neighbor Community Impact Award. Nominations are open and will be accepted through December 15th. Community Impact Award nominees may be an individual, group, or organization whose volunteerism and outstanding community service and dedication have made an impact on the Marion community. Ideal candidates exhibit the following attributes: has a positive difference in the lives of fellow residents, continually volunteers in the Marion community, demonstrates the spirit of collaboration, and is enthusiastic about the community as its and its residents. The recipient of the award will be recognized and announced by Mayor Nicholas Abuasali at the Marion State of the City in January. The award is named in recognition of banker Morris F. Neighbor. Neighbor began his career at Farmers State Bank in 1945 as a teller, and in 1968 he and his wife Betty purchased the bank. Through his leadership, the Neighbor family has given to many capital campaigns and nonprofit groups. Visit marionCC.org/community impact to access the nomination form. And the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation has announced a new grant opportunity, Nonprofit Recovery Grants, for nonprofit organizations in Linn County, with derecho-related recovery expenses for grounds that are used to provide key mission-based programming. The grants will provide funding up to $25,000 to reimburse the long-term recovery of grounds. Eligible expenses are those not being reimbursed from other sources. For more information, go to gcrcf.org/grants. And child care centers may apply for grants to increase service. Johnson County is accepting child care assistance expansion grant applications. The county may award up to $25,000 in funding to licensed child care centers located in the county and participating in Iowa's quality rating system. The grant application is located on the Johnson County website, johnsoncountyiowa.gov. And helpful holiday shop. This story by Michaela Ram. The annual mistletoe market benefiting Mercy Auxiliary is this week. The holiday season still is some weeks away, but a local event this week offers the opportunity for residents to get an early start on gift shopping. The 9th annual mistletoe market at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids will take place from 8:30 to 5 p.m. Thursday. The event is free and open to the public. The market will feature items from 40 Iowa-based vendors who are selling handcrafted, one-of-a-kind pieces, according to event organizers. That includes home decor, children's gifts, jewelry, and other items. This year's market is happening in person, bringing a new spark to the annual tradition after last year's winter market and its fellow spring event were canceled because of the ongoing pandemic. This is a good chance to support the community and get a leg up on holiday shopping, said Joyce Climes, co-chair of the Mistletoe Market. The dozens of vendors will set up shops starting at Mercy's 10th Street Southeast entrance and extending into the Halligan Education Center. A bake sale with homemade cookies, cakes, and other treats will also be set up within Mercy's Watts Library. Visitors can purchase raffle tickets for gift certificates and items from local merchants for $2 each or $3 for $5. Individuals can shop virtually at the Mistletoe Market this year, said event co-chair Holly Becker. Individuals can do so by visiting the event's website, mercycare.org/mistletoe. Masks are required at all times for those attending the market in person, event organizers say, and all proceeds of the event go to the Mercy Auxiliary, a fundraising organization run by volunteers who support various projects within Mercy. The organization was founded in 1923 and has served as a fundraiser for various projects benefiting the hospital ever since. This year, proceeds of the Mistletoe Market will benefit cardiac, thoracic, and vascular surgery services at Mercy. Becker and Climes said the auxiliary creates endowment funds for those departments to use as they see fit. Mercy Auxiliary also is fundraising to purchase Halo, H-A-L-O, sleep sacks, a type of swaddle that is sent home with every baby born at Mercy. The auxiliary has been financing those gifts for several years, its members say. Those who plan to attend the Mistletoe Market should park in the 10th Street parking ramp or across the street near McKinley Middle School. They should avoid parking in the Cancer Center parking lot or the 8th and 8th parking ramp. For more details on the vendors and other updates from the market, visit the event's website at mercycare.org/mistletoe. Officials warn the live market could be subject to cancellation due to COVID-19, so participants should check the market website for updates. Wrapping up with a recap of the weather news, today mostly cloudy, winds out of the northeast at 10 to 20. Cedar Rapids is looking for a high of 57 and a low of 39. Moving forward, some afternoon rain tomorrow and morning rain on Thursday, and then possibly a chance of light snow and windy on Friday. Winds out of the northwest at 20 to 30 miles an hour. Cedar Rapids high on Friday of 39 and a low of 27. Normally for this date, Cedar Rapids is 52 and a low of 34. The record high was set in 1999 at 76 degrees. Ooh, a record low of 4 degrees was set in 1925. We are in the waxing crescent moon phase. Sunset tonight's at 4:51 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 6:50 a.m. Today's daylight, 10 hours and 2 minutes. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, November 9. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.